I seem to recall once trailing my mum around the kitchen really late in the evening. She still brings this up, saying, "But why, mum? And is there a God? And what?" And she was like trying to make sandwiches for lunch the next day. She's like, "I have no idea."
Did she then say, "Ask your father"?
Hi, welcome to episode 35 of Art Juice, honest, generous and humorous conversations to feed your creative soul and get you thinking, with me, Louise Fletcher.
And me, Alice Sheridan.
This week, we have a great topic. We're going to be talking about finding our why for why we paint altogether, our why for specific series, and maybe even our why for a single painting. But first of all, let's just catch up. And Alice, you look like you've had a really exciting week. So I've been looking on Instagram. So tell me what you've been up to.
It feels like it's been longer than a week, actually. It feels like I've had 2 weeks squashed into one. So most of it is I had a little, I suppose you might call it an artist date, but it went on for about 4 days. So I had a little bit of time. It felt like a kind of bonus summer holiday, but I'm going to talk about that in What's Inspired. And the rest of what I've been working on this week has been full on, hands on, literally this morning. Hands-on nitty-gritty of moving stuff into the new studio. So that has involved trying to coordinate finding a timber yard, deliveries, when the guys are going to be able to come and build this false wall. Could it come on Saturday? Could I hire a van? If I had to hire a van, it has to be a full day. Just those kind of weird logistics of just getting everything there that I needed. It feels like I'm moving house, not just like moving a few painting things into an empty room, which should be simple, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah, when it's really not. I pictured it as, oh, Alice will like fill up the car with all her paints and stuff, and she'll just move them in. But you forget that you need tables and walls and...
And just even things like I was there really early this morning, and I did get a mug yesterday, but I've got no milk. So I'm thinking, right, I need a thermos to take milk in so that I've got milk when I want to have a cup of tea. And, you know, I need a scour, I need fairy liquid, I need all those kind of tiny little things as well as the big stuff. And I don't want to take all the big stuff to put on shelves until I've got shelves to put them on and da da da, all of that kind of stuff. And what was a little bit frustrating was I had started with the intention that I was going to find things secondhand, you know, not buy new. I was going to reuse. And I did my research and I found this supposedly great secondhand office store, and I thought that would have shelving and all sorts of things in it, but most of it was available for hiring for film and TV sets. And right. Then I did find a couple of things that he said, oh yes, those are for sale, but one of them, it was only like, I don't know, 30 inches long, if that, two shelves, melamine unit, really nothing special, and he wanted £90 for it.
London prices, Alice.
That's kind of what I did too. I was like, really? I thought you were going to say £30 for this. So I'm being on the completely the opposite end of maybe people who look at art and go, really? Why is it that much? But it's sitting there in this huge warehouse full of old furniture. And I'm like, I'm here. I've literally got cash in my pocket. I can give you cash and you will have cash in your pocket at the end of the day. No, not interested. So there you go. I'm back to IKEA.
Did you ever watch Fleabag?
Yeah.
Because on that show, at one point when she's in the cafe and she needs some money, she just tells people a sandwich is 30 quid or whatever. And she says London prices. And it's like, people are like, oh, whatever. They just pay it and walk out. So that's what I thought of when you said £90 for a rubbish melamine unit. London prices.
We're not fancy London. We're up in, you know, Park Royal Industrial Estate. There isn't anything fancy about this.
Yeah. Mad.
Madness. Anyway, I'm getting there. And I've accepted that it's basically going to take the rest of this month to get, or this week and next week at least, to get sorted out and settled. So just kind of, you know, one thing a day, but one small thing a day at the moment is taking all day. So there we
yeah.
are.
Yeah. Oh, it is exciting though. It's when we do something like this, you get bogged down in the practicalities of it, in the details of it, don't you? So everybody outside is thinking, oh, that looks so exciting to have all that big space to work in. But yeah. when you're in the middle of it, you're like, yeah, but I've just got to get through this list of things.
Yeah. And also I had a moving in budget for all the things that I needed to get.
And you've blown that.
You know, because you think, oh, what is it? It's only a sheet of MDF. That's not very much, is it? But by the time you've bought 9 of them and fixings and 500 screws and supports and...
Yeah. And the hardware, I always find anything to do with hardware is really expensive. Whatever you go buy, wood's expensive. Everything's expensive.
Everything's expensive. Everything. Yeah. One good thing that I do think about kind of grabbing the bull by the horns and doing things like this, though, is that you do, to a degree, you stop worrying about the little costs and the little things. So like when I'm at the timber yard and he's like, that will be £368, please. I'm like, okay, fine. And how much is that box of screws? And, you know, in a way, I think, could I go to B&Q and buy packs of screws in 50 and it would be cheaper? But when he says it's £5, I think, well, you know, compared to 368.
Yeah. It's only £5.
Shove it in, all of it. All, you know, paint, 25 litres of white paint. Yeah, shove it in. I'll have that. Yeah. Yeah, all of it. So, and I just find that really interesting, that mindset shift thing that happens about money when you're in different stages of things. And like whether there is a difference between paying for an object, like paying for physical materials, and being surprised at how much they cost, or paying for services. Do you have a difference between, like, yeah, some things that you constantly think, oh, that should kind of be free, and it never is.
Yeah. And I've got to go to the dentist tomorrow, I told you, and have yeah. I've got quite major dental work coming up, and the bill for it is quite but it doesn't feel as massive as if you told me. I mean, I bought a car for as much as I'm going to, I bought a secondhand car for as much as I'm going to spend at the dentist in the next few months. And admittedly, my car looks like it's been beaten up and it's old, but I bought a car for that much. But when I bought the car, it felt like a massive, massive decision when it was at the dentist saying, this is what you need to do. I'm like, all right, well, okay, I got to do it. And somehow I think of those things differently. And the amount I'm giving, I bought for a car, paid for a car, and the amount I paying to the dentist, I wouldn't go and buy a painting for. I certainly wouldn't.
Isn't it fascinating?
That's a bit disappointing, isn't it, of me? Because I think the car's practical, I'm driving it. The dentist is about my health and the fact that I don't want to walk around with false teeth, so I have to have this work done. But the painting is a luxury, and that's only for when you're really rich, so rich that you don't notice that amount of money going away, in my mind.
It's fascinating. And of course, we come across this all the time, you know, the other side of it. You know, how does it feel when you've got your work on display and you're expecting or hoping that people are going to buy it? One thing I would say about that is, on my weekend away, I was with a friend who is, I was going to speak French and I won't bother. She's much more glamorous than me. She's much more interested in clothes than me. So she's always, and my daughter always says, oh, she always has such nice things. She always has such nice things. And I'm here in my really tatty t-shirt, which, but you know, most of the time I'm not bothered by it. It's absolutely fine. Anyway, one of the things that we did was we were walking past and we said, maybe we'll have time for a little bit of shopping. So we went into this shop and there was a beautiful cashmere jumper and it was absolutely gorgeous. And I tried it on and it made me feel like I was like floating in these gorgeous soft clouds. But I just thought, this is a beautiful, beautiful thing. But I'm going to wear this on a daily basis and it's still going to get a hole in the front where my belt buckle rubs against the kitchen worktop. And I just don't want to spend this much pound on it. I know it's beautiful. I can see it's beautiful, but I just don't want to. Anyway, so I bought something else and we were wrapping it up. And then as we were leaving, she said, what about this? And she picked up this dress off the hanger, which I have absolutely no cause to wear whatsoever. It's a really fancy dress up dress, but perfect for those times where you think, I've got to dress up. I want to look a bit different. I want to look like I've made an effort. And when you go out looking for that, it's impossible to find. And I put it on and it was just like, oh yeah. And I think that's what it must be like when you buy a painting, because the two things were the same price. One of them I would have worn much more, but I decided not to buy it. Much more practical. This dress, not practical at all, but it was just right and I wanted it. That was it.
Yeah.
So it is a funny thing, spending money and, you know, all sorts of stuff bundled up in that. But
there is. It's a whole topic, money, our money mindset. And that ties into my week, because this week I had, last week I had two people get in touch to buy paintings out of the blue. But the amount I charge for my paintings is becoming an issue. And as a result of this, so the first person, she wanted something. I hadn't even thought of a price for it because I'd only just finished it. So I came up with something, and it's on paper and I don't work on paper. So I had to come up. I don't think I agree with this whole thing that work on paper should be cheaper than other work, but that's I'll have to decide that for myself down the road. So I gave a price, but I was tempted to give a price lower. I pushed it, the price, to what felt a bit better for me. She was very happy with it and she bought it. Then a man got in touch. He bought some paintings from me at Open Studios. He lives quite a long distance away, but he's coming back to Yorkshire in a few weeks. And there's one of my biggest painting that he must have seen then. And he said, can I buy that while I'm here?
Yeah.
Fantastic. But there's a very slight niggle in my mind that I don't think the price is high enough, and it's the price is what it is because he saw it then, and I'm not gonna say that it's more now. But I don't want to ever have that feeling when I sell something to someone that wasn't fair, you know, and that's a bit what it felt like.
Yep.
So we're on that, so it ties in perfectly to that money mindset thing, because I don't have, of the work that I finished last time, I have nothing left. It all went. The only stock that I have now is the paintings I completed, a few of the paintings I completed right after CVP. Some of those are gone as well, but everything after that, I've sold everything I've made.
Yeah.
And that tells me that my prices are not high enough.
Yeah.
And that, or that at least I could be charging more. So my mission for the next few weeks is to get myself into a mindset so that when I put the next set of work up for sale, which is I'm only just beginning to make, I have a feeling of, oh, good, when I sell something, which I used to have, as opposed to, yeah, that really should have been a bit more money. That's not fair.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my mission.
I think you're right, but I think in what you have to do is your current guy who's buying this big painting, you just, you know, it feels now like he's getting a really good deal, right?
Yes.
So that's a better way of thinking about it.
Yes. Yeah. And I feel delighted that he's buying it, because he bought two paintings for himself and one for his friend when he came.
Yeah.
And now he's coming all the way back to buy another one.
Yeah.
He obviously really loves my work. And so I don't mean to sound even slightly ungrateful. And I feel like I'm building up a relationship there for the future, which is all good. It's just that if he had been a stranger,
and I
was selling him that for that price, I know I'd think that wasn't really enough money. And so it's just something that I want to be aware of. And when I see what other people, what my peers are charging for paintings, mine are lower. And I think there's a danger that you can give an impression to people. Well, if you don't value yourself, other people won't. And if you put a low value on your paintings, other people will accept that as the value of them.
Yeah.
They won't say, oh, well, they're worth a lot more, but she's just not got enough self-confidence to charge the right amount. They'll just say, oh, well, that's what they're worth. Whereas that other artist we saw last year, hers are double that.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing in this is, and I know at the moment that you don't sell through galleries, but if you did have galleries approach you and you had even a few in galleries and you made a sale that way, what you'd get coming back to you at that point would be significantly different.
I know.
So that's also something else that you just might want to factor in at this point, so that that balance between what you sell direct and what you sell via other means kind of even each other out a bit.
Yeah. Mm. We shall see. So shall we move on?
Yeah, that was a meaty week, wasn't it?
It was. Maybe that should have been our main topic. Oh, well. we can always do that next
another time.
So this week we thought we'd talk about this question that actually came up towards the end of our discussion last week, when we started to talk about Alice had been to an exhibition and she came away with a really clear idea of what the artist was interested in and the issues that the artist had worked on for her entire career, and that they could be summed up in a couple of words. And we started to talk about whether we had similar purpose to our artwork. I'm also teaching a course at the moment where some of the artists are wrestling with this idea of, well, what is my intention for my art and what do I want it to be? So we thought talking about intention would be a really good subject. I read a book a few years ago by Simon Sinek called Find Your Why. His talk on TED is actually better than the book. I think the book was a bit...
Okay.
I didn't like the book. You were supposed to read the book with someone else and you were supposed to do it together.
I've read it, but a while ago.
At the time, I didn't have anyone else to do it with, and it just was a bit pointless on my own. You couldn't do any of the exercises on your own. But I do like the concept behind it, which is to think about why you're doing whatever it is that you're doing, and to boil that down and be able to explain that to other people in a way that they can connect with. So that works for if you're running a business, as I used to, that has nothing to do with art, but you what's your purpose for that, for why are you doing that? And it works in your life as well, because if you have that central idea, then it can guide how you live your life.
And I think it helps get you through the sticky patches too. I think that's the really important thing about understanding this about yourself, is that you know, when you hit those moments that you think, oh, why am I bothering, if you know what your bigger aim, what your bigger belief, what your bigger goal is, it keeps you going at those points.
So I think it can be that bigger why for your whole life, can't it? Why am I here? Let's answer that question before the end of this episode.
No. My answer to that my son, I remember my son asking me when he was about 6 or 7, you know, pretty much, mummy, what's the point of life? Why are we here? I was like, I mean, eat your fish meat. But I think I said to him then, you know, really, you have a lifetime to work that out for yourself, because it's different for all of us. And that's why you have a lifetime to do it, because it takes a lot of time.
Oh, that's a good answer, Alice.
Wasn't it?
That's very wise. And you came up with that on the spot.
I think I did. That was clearly a good parenting day.
It was, yeah. My mum, I seem to recall once trailing my mum around the kitchen really late in the evening. She still brings this up saying, but why, mum? And is there a God? And what? Yeah. And she was like trying to make sandwiches for lunch the next day. She's like, I have no idea.
Did she then say, ask your father?
Anyway, so having established that we can't explain the meaning of life, but there's like all these different levels of whys then. So there's the why of your existence. There's the why of your work as an artist. And possibly if, as you and I do, we also help other artists in different ways. So there's the why of that, which I think it's really important to know.
Yeah.
And then when you get into a series of work, you might have a why for each one that's different. So one series might be about one thing, one series might be about something different.
So is the first one, is the why are we even bothering with art in the first place? Why are you making art? Before you get into the what's the why of your particular art about, why are we even making it? Is that the first point?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, I can answer this one. Because if I didn't, I would be insanely grumpy, really frustrated. I would have to go and work in an office for somebody else, which I don't think would work very well these days. And I think probably more intrinsically to me, I've just always loved creating things. So I've always loved taking something and transforming it into something else and making something from nothing thing. And, you know, art is one of the things that does that, but I have other things in my life where gardening, not so much anymore. Gardening's really annoying because you put lots of work in and then it all just dies or needs weeding or
gets overgrown and
yeah,
messy.
And it all needs doing the same again the next year anyway. So I've kind of fallen out of love with gardening a little bit at the moment, but there is a kind of magic in that. But physical transformation, I mean, I felt it even this morning at 7 o'clock when this delivery lorry didn't turn up and I had my IKEA put together thing. It's just fun making something that was flat and all of a sudden it's a thing. And I know some people hate that kind of flat pack furniture. I just love the fact that here's the building blocks, you put it together. And in a way, art is the same, apart from you're doing it with no guide. You've got to figure out what your building blocks are, what the end result is going to be, and start before you even know what the answer is going to be. And I think that's fun.
I agree with you about art. I definitely do not agree with you about IKEA furniture. That's when I call somebody and say, I've bought this, it needs putting together, can you do it please? Oh no, I hate it. But I think, so I've always needed to create things too, but I was thinking about this morning. There's also a degree of, I want to be seen. I want to be seen. I want you to see my experience. And that's quite selfish. I was thinking, it's almost like I've seen stand-up comedians talk about this, that their whole act is basically get on stage and say, love me. You know, just love me, look at me, I'm so funny, everybody love me. And I think any kind of communication, whether it's writing or acting or comedy or singing or art, is about saying, here I am, and showing that to everybody. And I was thinking, I do have some people on my course who have no desire to ever sell or show their work, really. They just want to make it for themselves. So they have a different why, which is perhaps, like you said, to do with feeling happy and, you know, needing to create just to feel good, but not needing to go show it to other people and get anything back from other people. Whereas I definitely could not just make it for myself.
No, I couldn't do. I love that, getting it back. And I'm not really, a huge believer in star signs, but I'm a Leo, and one of the things about Leos is they like to be the center of attention. Surely not. You know, and it's that love me thing. And I'm not it's funny, isn't it? I'm just saying, I'm not sure. I don't need it from everybody because I'm totally at peace with the idea. Like, I have no anxiety about it, but maybe that's because it's been proved to a degree enough to make me feel okay. I don't have anxiety about standing in front of my work and showing it to people. And I do wonder if sometimes, and perhaps not for everybody, but some of the people who say it's only for me, I don't want to show it, I don't want to sell it, that's a protective fear-based mechanism to protect them and look after them, because it feels scary to put your work out there. And if you do that, of course, there's a chance that lots of people won't like it, lots of people won't buy it. And then where do you go with this precious creative thing that you love to do if you've exposed it to other people? And I often say to people, I think there is a stage at the beginning of a new creative project, and I'm quite happy with sharing things, but when you've got a new creative project, there is a stage where to a degree it's fragile and you need to look after it and protect it from all those outside comments and criticisms. Because when you get too many of those at the wrong point, then it undermines what you personally get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the I want to be seen, love me thing, I think we, it, and also this is very, not un-PC, but you know, we are not encouraged to acknowledge this. I want to be seen, love me, here I am, here's my work. Like it's kind of, yeah, and it's sort of encouraged. If you're an actor, if you've got a child that likes being on the stage, there's a vehicle for that. Here we go, here's a school play, on you go, do your thing. And everybody claps, and isn't it lovely? Nobody claps at art exhibitions.
No.
Even when you're a child. And I think it's just not encouraged, that wanting recognition thing.
No, and I don't know if it's different for kids these days, but when I grew up, it was don't show off. Don't blow your own trumpet. Don't make a show of yourself. Don't put yourself forward. And as quite a gregarious and bossy child, I had to have some hard lessons from my parents and my friends at school that I couldn't always be in charge and have everyone do everything I said, which I still have to learn now. But that, I think it's love me, look at me, but it's also partly look at what I see. So
right. Yeah.
Look at what I experience, because I've learned as I get older, oh, I don't experience the world in the same way as normal people. Like yeah. I don't. I have way more emotional ups and downs and way more strong reactions to things and to beauty and to ugliness and to all sorts of things that other people don't seem to react in the same way to. But it, and so there's this way that when you make your art, you can show it to strangers who do get what you get, or can at least respond to it and feel something from you, whereas perhaps the people around you can't.
Yeah, I agree entirely with this, you know. And perhaps that is the role of the artist, is to see things and to wake other people up to how things can be seen, noticed, discussed differently. How does this fit with the idea of the reclusive artist stereotype? And the fact that, you know, does it make us have two-sided personalities, that we have parts that we need to hide away and be selfish and obsessive about, and very interior looking? It's a very internal process sometimes.
It is. I was just thinking that I'm getting better as I get older, but for most of my life I didn't express what I needed or I didn't assert myself into the world, really, except in career. I did in my career, I was able to be very successful, but in every other aspect of my life I always put everybody else ahead of me and felt like everybody else was somehow more real and more important than me, and I was just not that. We're getting a bit psychological now, but art is a way that I can put all of me out and show all of me. And what's interesting is the more I do that with my art, then I start to do it in my life too.
Yeah.
So I'm much more assertive now than I used to be about what I need. But so maybe that's another reason why, is maybe that's the reason why the drive to make my art more my own, whereas I used to copy other people, as we've all done in the past, or used to struggle to find my way. But the drive to find my own voice, perhaps the why behind that was because I needed to do it.
Literally find your voice.
In life. Yeah. As you get into middle age, you need to start focusing on yourself more.
There's definitely a kind of self-therapy thing that goes on with art, in the sense that, you know, one of the reasons I didn't want to do fine art when I was a student, because I felt like I had nothing to say at that point. I hadn't lived enough. There was, you know, and maybe I just instinctively felt that how can you make art when you don't know yourself enough at that point, perhaps. Maybe that's what it is. It's about knowing yourself and getting comfortable with the idea that what you're putting into it is you, can only be you. And some of that.
And accepting yourself, I think. It's knowing and accepting. So it's, I used to think there was something wrong with me for being so emotional. I used to think that that was a flaw. And when I came to realize, oh no, that's actually a benefit, because I put that into my artwork and people feel it, then you're accepting this part of yourself that you thought was a problem. Yeah. So yeah. I can't let other people see that. That's to be ashamed of. Now I'm not ashamed of it. Like, if you don't like it, I understand, but that's who I am. And it, and my work is becoming more and more emotional as a result.
Yeah. And feeling like you don't have to change those things necessarily, or you don't have to if you don't want to. Thinking about my list of impatient, stubborn.
So if that's the why of why we want to be artists, so that's the top level.
Yep.
So then the why behind the kind of art that we make is perhaps harder for people to answer sometimes, I think. People listening might say, yes, well, I know I'm an artist for some of the same reasons, some different reasons. But there are often, people are often struggling with, but why, what's the intention behind my work? If I was to sum it up in two or three words to other people, what would I say?
And, which is what I said to you last week. I'm not sure that I can. And you said, looking at it from the outside, it's clearer, which is helpful to have somebody else to talk with about it, or ask somebody else to say, what do you see in my work? If you've got somebody else you can have that discussion with, can be very helpful.
And do you need it, is my question. Do you even need it? Or do we risk putting ourselves into pigeonholes to have it?
Yeah, totally. I think one of the biggest hang-ups for people getting started with work is, you know, is this it's such a cliche, isn't it? But it's this procrastination thing, and it can work both ways. It can stop you working if you feel like you don't have anything clear to be working on, so you don't start anything. Or you can stop working if you've got a really clear idea of what you want to be working on, and somehow it just feels too much or too daunting and you never get started on it. It's a bit like the dress at the beginning, like you're going out shopping. If I've got a really super clear idea in mind, like I want to buy a red dress with shoulders like this and sleeves like this that fits me just here and goes exactly this length or whatever, I'm never going to find it. It's just going to be a fruit. If I just go out with a sense of it would be great to find something that when I put it on felt special, and I don't know quite what it looks like yet, you're much more likely to find something that fits. And maybe that's the same with art, is that you need some kind of intention for what you're starting with, so that you don't go out looking for a smart dress and come home with a pair of jeans and pajamas. You know, but to be too precise about it before you begin means that it's just going to be frustrating and you're not going to get what you want, because a lot of the joy, arguably the entire purpose of it, is the discovery that you make along the way. You know, if you start off with something and you have a clear idea of what the outcome is going to be, that's a formula, that's craft, that's not art in my book. I think that's what the difference is in my head. But having a loose idea of what interests you at the moment and what you would like to explore or discover, I think that can be helpful, particularly if you feel like you're floundering and there are just too many options.
I think that's a really good point, because I've had people asking me on the course, they say it's great to have the assignments, but when we have in a week off this week, and now I'm faced with a blank canvas or a blank sheet of paper, and I don't know what to do. Mm. Now, I'm not worried about that in the course, because we haven't got to the point yet where they have a clear intention, and we will get to that point. But you do need something, because like you say, so even if your intention is, I want to find out how to make a painting in as many shades of blue as possible using these two blues, that's still an intention.
Yeah.
Or it could be something lofty, like I want to communicate the, you know, status of women in the world today. Or it could be, it doesn't need to be a great big purpose to everything we do, though.
No.
It's what you said. It just can be, I'm interested in exploring how to create a sense of space, or how to make, I'm interested in exploring this particular color. But you have to have something. And I think we all have something, but perhaps we don't know what it is.
But I think it clarifies through the process of working, doesn't it?
Right.
And you have to be responsive to, like, we all know what it feels like when you sit down at work at some, to work at something, and it just feels labored and awkward and doesn't quite work. And then when you have things that you think, oh, I'm really enjoying this, love this, doing this, you know, charcoal drives me mad, it's really messy and everything gets dirty and I don't like the marks I make with it, but when I get out ink, oh, watch it run, you know, whatever it is, that kind of thing. Now, does that then become a defined discussion about dry and wet materials? Are you process driven? Does the fluid of the ink feel exciting to you because you're talking about, you know, fluid life changes or whatever metaphorical discussion you want to have? Probably a combination of all sorts of things, really. But I think the ideas often only occur to you when you're in the process of working. You can't sit and define them in isolation.
Yeah.
But limiting yourself really helps, I think. So I think when I really first started, you know, I just had a sketchbook and I drew, you know, I was just going to do like little drawings of, like when the kids were sleeping, drawings around the house of corners of the house and objects. And I did it for a while, and a short while, after about 2 weeks, I just thought, gosh, this is boring me to tears. You know, this is not helping. This is not what I'm coming to art for. This, and I couldn't kind of work out why, because it wasn't, I should have been interested in the skill of the drawing, but it was because it was focused again on domesticity. And at that point, what I was looking to art for was an escape from domesticity. And as soon as I realized that, I was like, fine, I can ditch this project. This can just go. Forget this. This is not the right way in for me. But I probably, I'd never done it, there would probably have been this little niggly thought at the back of my mind that said, do a drawing every day. Drawing every day is really good practice. It's good for you. You should do it. And I would never have known that that's not it for me, unless I'd done it and very happily dismissed it and thought, great, good, can shut the door on that one and walk away.
Well, this is what happens during this course, because I give everybody very different assignments, especially at the beginning. They're free assignments, like about painting loose and free with no intention, but they're different from each other. And what people tend to do that is to say, I really didn't like that assignment. There must be something wrong with me, as opposed to what you did, which is, I really didn't like that assignment, which tells me something important about myself.
Yeah.
That I don't like. Like, one in particular was a limitations exercise where I give them specific steps. You can only have two colors and white. You mix up three colors, then you do two brush strokes, one mark with a pencil, one this, one that, and it's very rigid. And then you do lots of those and you start exploring within that, using the limitations to create something. Some people absolutely love that. Yeah. And really get into it. Some people are like, I don't like being told what to do. I don't like being told in what order. And that's a good thing. So, right, you know that now. You won't use that one again. But for the people who loved it, they've discovered that they enjoy the problem-solving aspect of working out how to use these limitations in a way that works for them. So it's all about, isn't it, trying things and then saying, right, just like you did, that's not for me. I'll move on. I took sketchbook school classes. That's a website, sketchbook school. It's really good for people who love that kind of drawing.
Yeah.
And I did that for a few years when I first got back into art. And like you, I dropped it after a while, but I was making just a daily diary through drawing. But I just found I wanted to do so much more because I wanted to express all this other stuff, which I couldn't express through drawing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's for some people, that's a good way in. You find your why as you go along.
Yeah. The important thing here is that this is something that nobody else can tell you. And I think that we have a driving urge to get to the point where we know it and we have clarity on it. And I think almost as soon as we get there, we're going to be bored of it. So what we've got to do is get comfortable with the idea of setting it's a sequence or a series of small steps up. And all you're doing is exploring at this stage so that you then can make a decision or a choice about what you do next. And there is a lot of talk at the moment about intuitive painting and just doing what feels right and all of that. And I just believe very, very strongly that that is important, but that we also have to have a stage where, you know, we are intelligent, intellectual human beings. And your role as an artist is to make, it's not just to work intuitively, it's to make conscious thinking decisions about things. And that's a responsibility for all of us in totally different ways, according to what different level we're at with our work, how experienced we are, how many of these things that we've tried and tested. And if it were straightforward and easy, we would all be drawing like Michelangelo, coming up with ideas like Leonardo da Vinci, executing them like Picasso. I mean, Picasso didn't get to the stage that he got to in 3 months, 6 months, whatever. That was a lifetime of continual development and idea change, all based around these kind of questions. Why am I interested in this? What am I doing? What do I want to show here? Yeah. Why is this important to me?
I think, though, on the subject of intuitive painting, partly why people get stuck is that they generally don't begin with that. They generally begin with the rules and the principles. Yeah. This is what happened to me. I got right composition and color and all this stuff, trying to learn that in order to be an artist before I had tapped into my own intuition and my own interests. And once I tapped into that, then I was ready to start learning, okay, I've gone blurt with all this intuitive stuff. What do I do next?
But you need both. That's my point.
You need both.
You do need an understanding of composition, what's satisfying, color, mixing, all of that kind of thing. And actually, if you don't have that, if you've got this really strong drive and you don't have the physicality to put it together, that would be equally frustrating.
But I think if you learn all those things, which most of us do first, what you end up with is, okay, but what am I doing and why?
Because it's hard to teach. Because who can teach you? You know, it is, you can be led, perhaps, you can be encouraged, you can be given the okay to explore.
Well, I'll tell you what changed it for me, though. It was taught to me, and it was Nicholas in CVP. And it was the simple block that was stopping me was not realizing that whatever I wanted to do was showing me the way. Mm. Not that what I thought I should do, but what I wanted to do was the first step towards finding my own way.
Yeah.
And I was working on one of my big Ted Hughes pieces the other day, and I was filming it for my course. And I suddenly looked at it. It's a big, big sheet of paper. And I was like, this looks pretty much like the very first play panel that I did in CVP when Nicholas gave us permission to do whatever we felt like doing. Now, when I put them together, the first one clearly lacked composition and, you know, the values were all off and that, but the idea was there.
Yeah.
It was quite surprising, actually. And it's taken me 2 years to get back to it, but in my own way.
Yeah.
But that's quite interesting. So it is within us. I didn't know why that was coming out like that. So when we played and I painted that, I knew that feels like me in a really weird way that I can't recognize because I've never done anything like this before. But now, 2 years later, I can say why it felt like me. But it just took that long to get to the why as well. That's the other thing. It's all that.
And in 5 years' time, you'll be doing something else, which is another step on from the painting that you're doing now. This happens exactly. Over and over again to me, is that you'll do something and you perhaps even think that it's a new idea or something you haven't done before. And then you might be flipping back through a sketchbook and you see it as some tiny, tiny little thumbnail squiggly idea or photograph or something that you stuck in years ago. And
yeah.
It's taken that long to kind of work its way through the kind of, it's like water filtering through the water system. It falls as rain. It goes all the way through this rock. Yeah, it takes ages. then eventually it kind of comes out again as a river, but we've just got to be okay with the fact that it's a journey,
not a destination. Put a little Instagram post about that. But so there's one other thing to cover here, which I wanted to cover, which was we've done the big picture artist. We've done the, okay, why are you making the work you're making? But something you always talk about is the why of each painting, which I always find really interesting. And since I'm doing this project now where paintings are inspired by specific poems, that's given me a very clear why for each painting, which has made my process so much easier. I have not had that before. What I'd done before is found my way gradually to a why and eventually said, oh, okay, it's going to be a red painting. That's what I'll focus on. Now I've got that and it's making things move much faster.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
But talk to us about what you mean by a why for each painting and how you use that in your work.
I think it was the moment that I realized that not a single individual painting could possibly be the total solution. It's a bit like the meaning of life being 42. You know, you can't get it all in one simple wrapped up thing. So therefore, as I was working, I just came to realize that each painting, there was going to be one thing that arose during the process of it. So the question might be, if I'm interested in space, how big a space relatively in this painting can I leave clear and still keep the painting interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of ideas. So they're quite kind of still process-led. They're quite structural in that sense. That's not meaning of life type why. That is physical painting solutions type why. And
on an individual level though, that's what you need, isn't it? So each painting has to be about something.
It does. And
otherwise
it
gets
lost. I'm also very interested more and more over the last year or so in the idea of paintings as a group having individual ideas and also how they work as a group together and making sure that there is variety and differences across all the paintings so that when you hang them together and they're seen together, they each have quite individual and different personalities or something different to say and yet still work together. Mm-hmm. I think that's quite an interesting conundrum that I'm working on at the moment. But just like you were saying, you know, when you start off with a drawing and how do you do line work and how do you balance, you know, positive and negative space or color mixing or those kind of things. And then you get into the deeper whys. I think perhaps now I'm at a stage where maybe the last 3 years has been about essentially learning how paint works, how I want to manipulate paint and what results it gives me that I find pleasing. That's taken 3 or 4 years. And maybe now I'm getting to the stage, right, well, okay, so now what do I want to say with this that's important?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little bit daunting.
But you see, you just answered your own question earlier because you don't have to know at the beginning. You're going to find it as you go along.
Yeah, well, let's hope so.
I think it's interesting because I went the opposite way around, where I know what, as I said before, I know my what I'm interested in. And actually the idea of connection, it even came up when we said our why as an artist, I want you to connect with me. I want to show you this so you connect with me. But I had that without any idea what I'm doing with paint. And I'm still in the process of learning what I want paint to do. So sometimes that can be a bit of a millstone. Well, not a millstone, but you can be disappointed with the outcome.
I think if you get to the point where you're bored, again, it comes back to knowing all the answers. I think if you get to the point where you know exactly what paint is going to do and it's no longer going to surprise you, you probably get bored with painting. And that's probably when you decide you want to be a sculptor or, you know, something else instead, isn't it? Because, you know, it's inherent in the questions. Anyway, listen, I think we've gone...
Do you think we've gone way too long?
But what I think would be really nice is to leave people with an idea of if you're sitting here kind of going, nodding your head, but what advice, is there a way that people can identify what stage they're at? Do we want people to go away with the idea that they're feeling it's okay? Do we want to give people an idea that it's worth sitting down and writing some ideas to get you started? How are people going to practically leave this rather than just nodding and going, yeah, recognize that?
Well, one of the things that I do in my courses, so they could translate this for themselves, is to try out lots of different things in a play form. And I know you don't love the word play, so exploration, messing about with paint and as many different tools as possible. Finding tools like twigs from the garden or kitchen implements, finding unusual tools, playing with paint and recognizing which things felt good. Like you said, don't like charcoal, but I like the ink. Recognizing those things is one key, I think.
Yep.
In conjunction with that is really reflecting and digging into the things that you care about in life.
Yep.
And why. So it's not enough to say, as I've said before, for me, I love being out in the landscape. That's all I ever used to say. But when you dig deeper into that, why? What is it? Because two people could say, I'm inspired by trees, and they could both be inspired by totally different aspects of trees.
Yeah.
So it's really digging into, what is it about trees? Is it the fact that they're very textured? Is it the fact that they're ancient? Is it the fact that you feel like they're alive and they talk to each other? That's just me, but I think trees all talking to each other when the leaves go. What is it about them?
And also then, why is that important and why is that relevant? And
yes.
You go further and further into this each time. So the same with me and my domestic like frustration with drawing. But I also know that what is important to me is helping women in particular probably have a voice beyond their role as mother and home. Not in a massively political way, but because I know that when I felt that I'd lost that a little bit, it felt like the rug had totally gone underneath my feet. So finding myself again and what I wanted to say and giving that value and recognition has been important. And this is, if you like, my why behind building what I'm doing within the Connected Artist, is helping people feel more confident that what they just want to give their time to is valuable. And it's going right back to the beginning. It's not always about sales. It's not always about making money. It's about saying, it's okay if I want to just do this because I enjoy it and it makes me feel better. That's okay too.
So we have no listener question this week because we talked for far too long about that subject. So let's talk about what's inspired us this week. Alice, what's lit your fire this week?
Well, I promised I'd tell you that. So I had a few days away, and this was prompted by wanting to get away from domestic stuff and just have an outing with a friend who is also an artist. And we found this one day with the colour tutor. So We will put the links in the show notes, but her name is Juliette Doherty, and she does these one-day colour mixing workshops, and then there's a stage 2 day, which would be quite fun to go back to as well. And it was lovely just to be instructed and taught and told what to do. That was kind of why I was there. I love colour. Like, this part of this whole journey started with my colour mixing 30 days back in April, whenever it was, a few years back. So it was nice to kind of do something along slightly more structured lines. But we were in Cambridge, so we had a great time investigating Fitzwilliam Museum, which was kind of like a mini version of the British Museum, but with nobody in it. So it was really cool. Amazing mummies. I mean, just beautiful. And then we went on to Kettle's Yard House, which I didn't even know existed. I thought it was just an exhibition space, but it's the house of Jim and Helen Ead, and it's three cottages that were put together in the, I think, mid-60s. And he was a curator at Tate Gallery in the 30s and was friends with lots of artists. And at that time, he was trying to persuade the galleries to show their work, and it wasn't really happening. But because of his friendship, he started collecting. So he'd have suppers, artists would bring paintings. So there is the most incredible private collection of work from Ben Nicholson, Alfred Wallace. He's got Brahms in there, Henry Moore, Barbara Hepworth, Miro. Just incredible. And the way it's displayed is in this beautiful paired back house. But his belief was that art should be enjoyed by everyone. So it's displayed with equal value alongside a very carefully arranged set of pebbles with graduated colours all the way through greys. Just the whole thing was a really beautiful experience. And he gifted it to Cambridge University. And one of the conditions was that it had to be open to everybody, so there is no charge, but you go in on a time ticket. But once you're in, apparently you can stay. So if you want to, you could take a book, sit down on the sofa. There are no labels on everything, so it's a bit like kind of Hunt the Artist. You're walking around and going, oh, there's Roger Hilton. It's just, you know, it was incredible. Really, really, really lovely. Found it very inspiring in lots of ways. And but it was beautiful. It was really beautiful. So if you're ever going to go to Cambridge, please make sure that you go and see that, because it's well, well worth it.
So my inspiration this week came from my oldest friend. I went out with him yesterday. Until then, I didn't have anything to tell you about as inspiration, except to keep going on about Ted Hughes. But we went out for a drink, and my friend is a deputy headmaster in a primary school. And it's a difficult primary school in a quite poor area of Bradford. So there's a lot to that job. He works very hard and he's always there late. And but he's also a playwright, and he's written, I think we added up about 40 plays since I've known him. He's had minor successes, occasionally on in London at a theatre somewhere, occasionally on the BBC on Radio 4, but never had any big breakthrough.
I think you've spoken about him before. Was he the guy that came up when you were talking about how you're changing things, and then he's been...
Yes, and he's been doing... And he's been deciding to cut down on his hours at school. So last night, the inspiration was that a few years ago, he told me he was going to write a novel. And he finished it, and he has sent it to an agent who expressed interest. Who knows if it will become anything? But the reason it was so inspiring to me is, so he's written 40 plays since he was 20. He's now written a novel. He works long hours. And the way he does his writing is he gets up at 5 a.m, and he's always done this ever since I've known him, to write for a couple of hours before he has to start getting ready for school, because he's always too tired in the evening. And then every holiday he writes. He always had a notebook. Everywhere I've ever been with him, he has a notebook to write notes down. And we so often hear artists say, well, I'd like to do my work, but, you know, I have a full-time job and now I can't get back to it. And to see how dedicated he's been, and to see that he's actually written an entire novel in the last 3 years while doing that work, it's truly inspirational. Because, and he said, well, I just don't wait to feel like it.
Yeah.
I just do it every day. And some days are rubbish. Some days I don't write anything good, but I was there for 2 hours before I went to work.
Yeah.
So I just found that very inspiring. Hard work is inspiring.
It is. I don't think we can hear that story often enough because everybody gets waylaid. But I think what you realize with that is, even as he says, you don't make big jumps every time you turn up to do it. Over the course of 3 years, what have you got? You've got a novel that existed that was never there before.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So if it's ever published, I shall tell you all his name and you can go out and buy it.
Good. Do that.
Right. So I think we have gone on and on and on, but I enjoyed that conversation. I thought it was really good. I hope you did too. As always, we would love you to recommend this podcast to anybody else. We would love you to write us a review if you haven't already. And that's it. That's it from me, Louise, and that's it from Alice.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Got the dog warming my feet here. I'm trying to get the dog to not sit on the sofa all the time. I want to get her in her basket, but you know, she wants to sit on the sofa.
You can't blame her, really.
No, I'd sit on the sofa. Actually, that was interesting. I put a post on Instagram and said, who would have a sofa and who wouldn't in the studio? And it was 78% had a sofa, but I also did get lots and lots of messages from people who said, if I had a sofa, I'd lie down and never get up.
So well, I have a sofa perfect. And it's in the way. My sofa is in there because it's a sofa bed and it's in the way. And if I do get this garden building built, I want rid of the sofa.
So you won't
but have... But you've got acres of space in this new studio. I will still have a small space, so it's different.
But it's still going to get filled. It's still going to get filled. I can see it looks huge as a big empty space, but, you know, already I can see that it's going to get kind of chunked up if I'm not careful. So I haven't thought, that would be a really nice thing to do. Also, it's going to be darn cold in the winter. And also, I'm supposed to be there working, not sitting on the sofa.
Exactly. And you're going to need to be dancing to keep warm.
I might be.
How will you heat yourself?
I've got a little fan heater and I've got... Which is not going to work, is it?
No.
It's really not.
Put it right next to you.
I might have to kind of strap it to my leg with elastic so it drags around like a ball and chain after me. I'm going to have to wear thermals and a hat. Although, actually, when I went yesterday morning and it was fairly early, it was warmer in the studio than it is in our house because it's got really good double-glazed windows in it.
Right.
Maybe we might find that once it heats to a certain degree, it kind of retains the temperature a bit. How's that for optimistic thinking?
That is optimistic. Yeah, but we shall keep... You're going to look like one of the flumps. Have you seen the flumps?
I need to buy lots of... forget fancy dresses, I tell you. I just need to buy lots of thermal underwear and baggy thermal trousers.
And then we want to see lots and lots of pictures.
I'll do it. I promise I will. Right, let's get on.
Okay.